Well, I talked this afternoon about someone rather more contemporary who died not that long ago, Cornelius Van Til, and I talked about him as developing a Christian worldview and seeking to be a consistent Calvinist. And I had noted this afternoon that John Calvin became the great systematician of the Reformation, picking up from Luther, among others, and doing that great work in the Reformation. And this year, we celebrate the 500th anniversary of his birth. He was born on July the 10th, 1509. And we saw particularly that it was Calvin who sought to tease out the full implications of the gospel for the whole of life. So let's talk tonight a bit about Calvin himself. We're going to have a few little things running here. There are his dates, as you see, 1509 to 64. He was born in Noyon in the Picardy region of France and was educated in humanist circles, humanism having come into some flowering as a part of the Renaissance, which preceded the Reformation, this sort of recovery that was going on of a lot of the classical sources, the Greek and Latin sources. The cry was ad fontes, to the sources. So these humanists said ad fontes, and they went to a lot of the particular classical writers, and when religious writers are going to pick that up, to the source is going to be particularly back to the Scriptures. Because what was being read largely by those who studied theology or studied religion was the church fathers or the medieval fathers, and they're very valuable, and we ought to read those. Calvin read them and knew them, but the Scriptures were not being studied as they ought, and Calvin sought to do that and endeavored to do that as things progressed in his career. But he was educated in these humanist circles and was pursuing at an early age a theological career at the behest of his father. His father was a notary in the local bishop's secretarial service, and he had great plans for his son, great plans in the church for his son, and he managed to get a couple of benefices for Calvin at a young age. This is one of the problems in the late medieval church. There were a number of abuses that went on in the church, and one of them was that there were these sort of places, these preaching positions or these church positions that you could secure, and they would give you a certain amount of money, but you wouldn't have any responsibility. I remember my wife was reading a book once, and she came across that word, an English book. An English novel, I think, sinecure. And she was saying, what's that? And I said, well, that's a sinecure. It means literally without worry. I said, it's something in which you get paid money, but you have no responsibilities. And my wife said, how can I get one of those? She said, that doesn't sound too bad. But they had these sinecures. And so Calvin was on track to do what the church in his day was doing. Between about 1523 and 27 and 28, he took an arts degree at Paris. He attended, among other colleges, the Collège de Montaigu, which Erasmus and Loyola and a number of others studied there. That college was famed for its ascetic strictness. Erasmus said that the horrible food served there permanently ruined his digestive system. So some things never change, you know. Cafeteria food, I guess. His father was excommunicated from the church in 1528. Yes, Calvin's father, who was a notary in the bishop's service, was excommunicated. And this is sort of the end of his wanting his son to pursue this career in the church because he's on the outs now. And he decided that his son should pursue a career in law. It's interesting here because it's sort of the opposite of Luther. Right, Luther's dad wanted him to pursue a career in law, and that's what he was doing until the thunderstorm, in, as you recall there, in 1505, and then 1506, he goes in and becomes a member of the Augustinian order of monks. But here, Calvin has the opposite sort of experience, and his father says, now you're going to study law, not theology, religion. And so, having gained his master's in Paris, he dutifully went to Orléans. That's the same as, you know, the city down in Louisiana which is New Orleans, but we don't say it. It's more like New Orleans or something like that. You hear people say New Orleans, and you know they're from who knows where. So he went to Orleans to study law. His real passion, though, Calvin's personal passion, then and thereafter, was classical studies, in which he returned in Paris after the death of his father in 1531. When his father died in 1531, he figured, well, that obligation to follow after the law that he wanted, that's over. I don't want to do that. Calvin, contrary to what you might think, Calvin was a rather retiring sort of fellow. That is, he wanted peace and quiet. He loved nothing more than to be in his study with his books and to study these classical authors. And he knew that the law, that there's a degree of controversy. And Calvin's life was a storm of controversy. But that's not what he wanted. He wanted basically peace and calm. Well, let's take just a break now. We're leaving him here in 1531. Let's think a little bit about what folk make of this giant of the Reformation. The name evokes widely varying reactions. The Roman Catholic Church has historically considered him to be really one of its greatest foes, as much as they might portray Luther if you read the Catholic Encyclopedia, not the New Catholic Encyclopedia of the 20th century, but the Catholic of the 19th. The New Catholic is a kinder, gentler Catholic Encyclopedia. The old Catholic Encyclopedia sort of shows Luther as probably crazy, a crazy monk. And Calvin, though, Calvin is just evil, according to the church. He's this evil genius of the Reformation and is highly despised. There are various sorts of apocryphal stories that as a youth he was called by his fellow youths the accusative case, because apparently he was rather reproachful of their immorality and of their looseness. Accusative case, of course, coming from grammatical, that's the direct object. I know you all know that, but that's the case in the Latin or Greek that has that. And, you know, was he called the accusative case? It is the case that when all of his friends, as he went along, were out pub crawling and wreaking general havoc about the town, Calvin wouldn't join them because he wanted to save all of his money for, what would you save your money for? Books. And what else would you save your money for in those days? Books. How are you going to read them? Candles. Right. Books and candles. Well, couldn't he just go and turn the light on? Well, of course not. Now, books and candles, that's where his money went. And so he has a sort of reputation of being a bit strict. Some of his enemies even went so far as to say later on that his wife died of boredom. Not very kind. Will Durant, you might be familiar with that set of books by Will and Ariel Durant that were quite popular. They've been over the course of years. The History of Western Civilization. And Durant acknowledged that Calvin's Institutes, he called it one of the 10 books that shook the world, but he also said that Calvin's theology, this is how he described Calvin's theology, as the most blasphemous and monstrous notion brought forth in the long history of nonsense. I don't think he liked it. He's portrayed as a great villain of the Reformation by many. On the other hand, Stauffer, in his marvelous little work on the humanness, that's been reprinted in more recent times. I just saw a copy of that. A book called The Humanness of John Calvin portrays him rather differently. He certainly is reserved, and so he didn't express himself. Luther, for example, Luther was the kind of fellow that, you know, you would like to have over in an evening and have some beverages, and he would be probably somewhat funny and tell some stories. That wasn't Calvin. He was very reserved. He was not outgoing in that way, and he could be viewed as cool and impersonal. Yet, Stauffer portrays him as very tender with close friends and cites the evidence. He would weep at baptisms that he would perform often and at weddings. It's kind of an interesting thought there. Calvin's marrying the couple and he's crying. You know, the wife's like, get on with it now, but he's crying. But he was also very generous. In Geneva, when he was there, lots of pastors and Protestants of various stripes would be coming through Geneva. They were refugees, like Calvin himself was going to be a refugee in Geneva from France. The Catholic faith is not permitting some of this Protestantism at that point in France, and so many people are leaving, and other places. And they're coming. Geneva is very much on the crossroads. They're coming through Geneva. Geneva's probably gone by already on here. They're coming through Geneva, and Calvin. This is very striking, particularly for any who are pastors, who are bibliophiles. You love books. Calvin would have a pastor come into a study, and when the fellow would leave, you know, when you're a refugee, they're coming. You don't get to pack a lot of stuff and take a lot of stuff. And he knew that pastors had left their churches, had left their books, and they came. And he would say to a pastor, "Okay, you see that, you know, those two or three sections, go in there and take, go in there and take 30 or 40 books." I mean, he would give away that number, which was a tremendous amount, particularly back then. Stauffer figures that he gave his complete library away a number of times over. And he wouldn't take pay raises. Maybe I shouldn't be saying this. Don't apply this here locally, folks, or expect anything by this. But he would refuse these raises. They wanted to give him a good bit of some gold, and he said, "I don't want it." And they said, "We'll give you this very big cask of fine wine," and he took that. But so he would take certain things. So again, he was also, though he was very generous and tender with close friends, he was also, by his own admission, hot-tempered, and he could be relentless in debate. There is some evidence, there are a number of instances where things happen and in Geneva, and everybody else is backing down, and everybody else is saying, "Okay, we won't go that way," but Calvin's not. He was a sort of a pit bull. He could, if he got something in his jaw, he didn't tend to let go of it. So, I mean, the reputation that he had with people could often be because they knew him in a certain way. They knew him as this relentless. Now, he obviously thought he was defending the faith, and he often was. But sometimes those who defend the faith defend things that aren't always necessarily articles of the faith. They're what you think ought to be done. But he was not one to be trifled with. He looks rather severe with the beard, and he's thin, and he's seen as somewhat ascetic. But he was never a man to be pushed around. And if you came thinking, "I'm going to push him around," you can think again. He was going to resist you at all costs, if that's what was going on there. He was a man of remarkable energy, who gave himself to the Lord and wore himself out for the sake of the gospel. His friends would often, even mildly reproach him and say, "You should take better care of your health," because he would go a couple of days without eating. He would sort of, he would eat and then would think, "Oh, I'm not going to eat," and so he would go a couple of days without eating. He would go a long time, he would work a great deal without sleeping. And when he would take to bed in his sickness, there's this certain type, he would take to bed in his sickness and he would just be working. He would be writing, working on commentary sermons, and friends would come and beseech him to take it easy, rest. And he would say, "What, my Lord, come and find me not at his work?" And so he was very dedicated. And you get this kind of thing, Just as another example, Charles Haddon Spurgeon would take to the bed with gout and other sorts of maladies. If you know the Treasury of David, he wrote that entire thing while he was in bed. I don't mean on one occasion, but that was the work he did when he was in bed, not feeling so well. you know. And we're happy because we did the crossword puzzle. You know, I mean, it's because we weren't feeling too well, or the Sudoku or whatever. A few other, and you know, I tried to look on the list. I'm not sure that I saw all the title. The way I had the list out that Alan sent, that I had all the information that I needed for the bibliography. So I'm not sure what's out on the table. Do you have the Zelder Heist biography back there? What biographies do you have of Calvin? The T.H.L. Parker, the Stickelberger. What do you have? Okay. Godfrey's of Calvin and Luther and. Oh, the recent one of Calvin. Well, those are both good, because I thought I saw both of those Godfrey ones. They're very well written. They're very accessible. Both his and the one on the Confessions and the little Reformation sketches. Is that what it's called? Is that? Yeah. Can the book table man, Reformation sketches, you have that? Okay. Well, don't look. I thought you might know what was there. But Reformation Sketches by Godfrey, you got, okay, good. That's a good book, and the Calvin book, very accessible. Hermann Zelderheis has a very fine new biography, which is published by IVP, based on his correspondence, based on Calvin's correspondence. It's a very balanced work. It's very fair to Calvin. It's critical. In ways that it ought to be critical. I mean, Calvin is not beyond criticism. Calvin would think it ridiculous if you thought him beyond criticism. Calvin, if there's anything about Calvin, what's the heart of Calvin? The heart of Calvin's system, approach, project is really to exalt God and abase man. That's and I think that's why Calvinism is so despised, because at its heart, that's what it does, really. It exalts God and abases man. So Calvin would have no use, I think, for something that made him a plastic saint. He knew, you can read it in his letters, that he had a temper problem. And he knew that he was sinful in ways. So for us, I don't know why we tend to do that. And we as Christians, we tend to be black and white. This person's good, and they're wonderful, they're no problems, or they're not, and they're virtually the devil. And I understand that. I think it's a Southern thing, too, particularly. I'm a Southerner. I know. And the best of us, whoever that is, are mixed. We're very mixed. Well, he was, as I say, he wore himself out. He had a number of health problems, kidney stones, gout, migraines. He would preach with migraines. We couldn't see half the text. He left us about 50 volumes of commentaries, 35 volumes of letters, 2,500 sermon manuscripts, other tracts and treatises, and of course his masterwork, The Institutes of the Christian Religion. Now, a lot of this, the sermon manuscripts, were in these folio volumes. And at the end of the 18th century, in the late 1700s, you'd had the Enlightenment happen, and you'd had all sorts of things happen, and Calvin in his own Geneva wasn't that appreciated. And the librarian in Geneva sold off about 3/4 of these sermons that were in folios. They were the only copies we had. So I think I was just talking to Cornell Venema about the numbers yesterday. Venema is the president of our school, but he's a PhD in Calvin from Princeton. So he knows Calvin very well and all the specific details as someone who's been working on Calvin for 25 or 30 years. And of course, he almost starts to cry when... He's somewhere between crying and being very angry at this librarian of many hundreds of years ago who got rid of these folios to make some room, because he wanted more room in the library. And they've been found in different places and some out-of-the-way bookshops. And he was talking about someone who found a couple of these volumes And it was one of these bookshops where they were somewhere in Europe, and they were selling them by the feet, or, you know, just so much a foot. And he kind of goes up to the clerk, you know, you're trying to be inconspicuous. And I had this happen once. I was in a bookshop that I saw a book. It was $12. And I happened to know this book was worth at least $200. And you're like, I'll take this book for $12. You know, you're just hoping, because the guy's got, wait a minute. You're not getting out of here with that book for $12. You know, you're trying to be inconspicuous. Yeah, I'll give it, this isn't worth anything. Well, I'll give you $12. You're hoping he doesn't figure it out. But anyway, so that's even Calvin. I mean, stuff thrown away. That's pretty bad. I mean, you were upset because your wife threw away your old jersey. I mean, you know, but this is pretty bad here. Well, let's go back to Geneva. We're going to head toward Geneva. We left Calvin off in 1531. He's wanting to pursue a career as a humanist scholar. His father's no longer there, so that's what he's pursuing. He's a very fine Latinist. Very fine stylist in the Latin language, and he publishes a work on the Stoic Seneca's De Clemencia on mercy, divine mercy. And it doesn't really, this book that he publishes doesn't make that big of a splash. So he's a little disappointed there. He's a little uncertain of what the future might hold. And he's at this time involved with a number of Protestants he's becoming to be involved with there. He's in Paris now. And particularly Nicholas Kopp, who becomes a little bit later the rector of the University of Paris. And of course, Kopp is going to give a famous speech that's going to kind of rock the boat there in the 1530s in Paris. He's the rector of the university, and he gives a Protestant speech, and it's a speech in favor of the Protestant Reformation. And we now know, again, from some historical work, that Calvin appears to have had a rather large hand in that speech. Some scholars think he more or less wrote it. Calvin, that's another thing, when I mentioned to you all his work, ultimately, those volumes of letters. He's very influential through these letters. And I mean, if you read something like the Belgic Confession, which is very like the Gallican Confession, which is very like Calvin. I mean, there's stuff in the Belgic Confession that sounds like it just came right out of Calvin, because it sort of did, more or less. And he would be writing people, and you know how it is, that they didn't have cut and paste on the computer, but you got this letter from Calvin explaining all this stuff theologically, and you're like, wow, this is really good. I just got to, you know, copy this down. This is good stuff. Somewhere late in 1533 or early 1534, Calvin probably was converted. We're not really sure. There's some bit of dispute about the dates. But he talks later in his commentary on the Psalm about a sudden conversion, sudden conversion or an unexpected conversion, depending on how you translate it. And he talks about his heart being subdued to the Lord. I mean, that's basically what we have. Like I say, I think 1533, late 1533, early 1534 is, I think, some of the better evidence. But again, we don't have some great account of some crisis conversion, so much so as we just have this recording of his heart being converted unexpectedly and being subdued to the Lord, coming into submission to the Lord. And he began from that point to champion the Protestant cause in an outward way. By March 1536, Calvin has amazingly produced the first edition of the Institutes, which will be expanded over the years through the final 1559 edition. In fact, they're going to be, in addition to the first edition, there are going to be editions in 1539, 43, 50, and 59, and also these are Latin, and then his own French editions in 1541, 45, 51, and 60. So the last two editions in Latin and French, respectively, are 59 and 60. And I don't know, have some of you seen, have you ever seen a copy of the 1536 it's published in more recent years. If you've, I'm sure most of you have seen Calvin's Institutes, whether it's the two volumes, whether it's the older Beveridge edition, which fell into disrepute, but now is being rehabilitated. I had one elder who told me he really preferred Calvin in the Beveridge edition, but then it later hit me why he said that. It didn't have anything to do with the translation. You just think about it. He was a fun guy. Whatever edition you have it in, it's a fairly long work by most standards. But the first edition is fairly slim. So he expands it considerably. But he's still 26 when he writes this. So he's been converted. One thing I read that was kind of amused me some years back, someone said, and you sort of see this in our typical individualistic Baptistic sort of culture, someone said, how could he have just been converted in maybe early 1534, and 2 years later he writes this remarkable thing? And this person was saying, and they were well-meaning, but I think they were misguided. They said, he's just a baby Christian. Well, Calvin had been brought up in the Christian faith his whole life. You know, it's when Paul met the Lord Jesus on the road to Damascus, it wasn't like all the scriptures he had ever learned didn't count, and that it all clicks in. It's the same with Calvin. I mean, he had been taught the rudiments of the Christian faith, and then he had been involved with the Protestant movement. There had been this stuff there. So, I mean, you know, it's sort of like people when they raise questions of, should we catechize our children? Should we? What if they're not converted? As if we don't somehow assure ourselves, because at home we sing "Just as I Am" and they walk down the hall or something, and then we say, yes, now we can teach them. No, you teach them. You say, what if they're not converted? Well, when they get converted, they're going to have a whole lot of good stuff there. If that's the concern, I mean, just to put it in those terms, because it's not that it doesn't count until the point of conversion. So, I mean, you know, Calvin wasn't 2 years old, if I can put it that way. He was 26, and he knew a lot of theology. He knew the church fathers. He knew the medieval writers, Lombard. Somebody, you mentioned the sentences, and he knew that stuff. He knew that stuff very well, and it's all there in place. Well, the thing is this. This Institutes was immediately recognized as a work of great theological genius, and was hailed by and welcomed by folk in the Reformation as the major kind of apology for the Reformation. He dedicates it to Francis I, who's the King of France, and he's particularly seeking to get Francis to recognize what's going on in the Protestant Reformation and to reject the lies of the opponents of the Reformation. Particularly, he's trying to distinguish what he and the Protestants are doing from the Anabaptists. He's trying to make it clear that we're not threats to the state or its welfare or security in that introduction. But most of the major themes of his theology are set out there in a style that's rather mature and noteworthy for his 26 years. Following the overall outline of Luther's small catechism, he deals in four chapters with the main topics of the catechism: the law, the gospel using the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, and then the sacraments. And then he has two apologetic chapters that are appended on the five false sacraments of the Roman Church and on Christian freedom, ecclesiastical power, and civil government. Now this is going to change. This structure is going to change, and certainly it's going to get a great deal bigger. But the basics of his system are there. That doesn't change. Well, in 1534, in the midst of all of this, going back a little bit here from the Institutes, there is after Cop's address, there are a lot of placards, posters, signs that go up around Paris, trumpeting the Reformed faith or the Protestant faith and attacking the Mass and various things. This causes some trouble, particularly because there's different accounts of this, but one of these placards is posted to a door very close, or either some cases say on the door of the king's bedroom. The king is not very happy about this. In fact, he's hopping mad about it and feels quite threatened by it, that somebody posted this placard on his, or close to his bedroom door. And so things heat up in France, and Calvin has to flee France. And so he goes and he comes back, but in 1536 he's leaving again with the intention of going to Strasbourg and pursuing there a life of quiet scholarship. That's his hope. And he goes through Geneva and going there. And of course you may know that story of Guillaume Farel, who meets him. And again, it's funny how we sort of just take these things so matter-of-factly. You know, Guillaume Farel comes and says, "You have to stay here and help us reform this city, and the Lord will severely judge you if you don't." I mean, I think we need to say, that dude was crazy. I mean, that's why, you know, this is crazy. I mean, really, in a certain sense. I mean, this guy coming. And Calvin sort of thought, like, wow, who is this guy? I mean, he's scary. And so Calvin was a little, you know, about the whole thing. But he did stay. He did stay. The city of Geneva had embraced many elements of reform already under Farel, and others had gotten rid of the prince bishop that they had elected a little council of 200, and there was reform going on in Geneva. And so Calvin, with some persuasion, reluctantly agreed to stay, but then he immediately began the work of reformation, producing a confession, seeking to reform elements of the church order, church discipline. The city council agreed to the first, to reform the church order. And ultimately, you may be familiar with the Genevan liturgy. Many of our churches have a sort of version of that. We follow some kind of version of that liturgy that Calvin had in Geneva, or in some modified ways. So that went through, but the church discipline part, the city council did not like that part. They wanted to keep the power of excommunication in the hands of the magistrate and not permit the church to exercise this authority. Now, let me just stop and say, in the Middle Ages particularly, church discipline was regularly abused by the church. Church discipline was used for political reasons. You disagreed with the church. There was a prince who took an action, a duke who took an action that the church didn't like, and they would excommunicate him, or they may put his whole area, his duchy, or his nation, if it were a king, under interdict, and the priests there couldn't perform certain of the sacraments. And so Rome used this, the Bishop of Rome used excommunication as a tool to shore up his power, so that when the Reformation came, you see, the conception of the Roman church had been that the church is over the state. Well, the conception in the Eastern church, where you had what's called Caesaropapism, was that the state is over the church. But it was like nobody could see it any other way. Either the state is over the church, or the church is over the state. Now, if I were to put the question to you, which is correct? I hope you'll quickly say, C, none of the above, because neither of those are correct. They both are properly under God and have their own proper place, sphere, order, etc. It's been spoken of as realm in many different ways. It isn't that one is over the other, but before the Reformation, that was not clearly seen. And even early in the Reformation, people like Calvin had to fight hard. Because you see, the magistrates in a town that had reformed, they're saying, well, the church discipline, the power to excommunicate, is not going to be in the hands of the church anymore because they've abused it. So it's going to be in our hands. And Calvin agrees that it's been abused, but he's trying to get it properly into the church's hands and properly used by the church. Because that's not a matter of the church being over the state. Church discipline does belong to the church. The power of the keys, as we call it, are properly exercised by the church, not the state. The state has the power of the sword. The church has the power of the keys. And they shouldn't be confused, and one shouldn't seek to exercise the other. But here you have those who have the power of the sword mistrustful of those that have the keys and wanting to exercise it themselves. But Calvin resists. He resists. And when Calvin resisted something, he resisted. And he even himself later admits, he didn't admit he was wrong, and he wasn't wrong, that he may could have done it better. But basically what happens is in 1538, the Genevan town fathers say, leave. You and Farel, just get out of town, basically, because you're wanting to control the communion and who comes to the table, and we're not going to put up with that. And Calvin's opponents had won office, and he and Farel were forced to leave because Calvin had said that he wouldn't administer the Lord's Supper to certain people who needed to be disciplined and who were openly immoral. I always get this picture of, you know, he just walked out of town. I mean, but if he were riding in something, and if it had a rear view mirror, you could sort of see him not exactly feeling too sad as Geneva fades into the background as he ignominiously leaves town. I mean, he's been thrown out and he's had a lot of trouble there. He goes finally to Strasbourg. Remember, he was heading there, and now he makes it there, and he's there for 3 years and he loves it there. Martin Bucer is there, the peacemaker of the Reformation, and he and Calvin get along. Calvin sort of, I mean, they have their issues earlier on, but Calvin looks to him as kind of a father figure, and he's influenced by the church order there, which has it's a doctor, pastor, elder, deacon, that is to say teacher, professor, pastor, elder, deacon. He goes to employ that order later in Geneva. Also, the Genevan order of worship and its psalmody, he reforms some of his notions of that and takes that back from Strasbourg. He also likes the school system that they have there, and he comes to model the Genevan Academy that's formed in 1559 on it. And his friends there, who are always, he's got some friends there sort of saying, you know, he needs a wife. And when he's 31, he marries Idalette de Bure, and they have a happy marriage. They don't have surviving children. It's about 8 years, and you'll read different things. I mean, it is true that, you know, when he marries his wife and what he says, when his friends are trying to get him interested in various people and he's not interested, or when he says, then he tells one of them in a letter what he wants in a wife, and it sounds more like a cross between, you know, a maid, a secretary, an assistant. I mean, it won't be made into a Hollywood movie, I can assure you. But he marries on rather pragmatic grounds, but he comes to have a very close and loving relationship with his wife. He's also close to his brother, though a lot of, he's ultimately grieved a lot by, he has a couple of family members that cause him considerably grief. One of them embezzling money from him. So he has his share of personal difficulties. Well, in 1541, he's been in Strasbourg for a few years. He's enjoying it there. Supporters of Calvin gain the upper hand, and they invite him to return. Not surprisingly, Calvin's not real eager to. Many still opposed him. Many still revised. Of course, Beza is his earliest biographer, his successor, and he talks about the libertines and the Nicodemites and others. You can look into these. There are a lot of opponents there. Sadoleto, you've seen him. There he is. Sadoleto, there he is. One of Calvin's opponents. Castelio, Balzac, and others. Some sort of theological, some personal, like Perrin and Bertellier. But he was reviled, and Beza said that some people called their dogs Calvin. There's once when he goes into the pulpit and he finds a note, a threatening note, and it has vulgarities in it. You and your kind, we're going to kill you, and we're going to do this and that and the other. And usually Calvin is like, you know, he preaches. I mean, it's not like nothing phases him. That's one of the great ones, is one of the great little stories, is when he leaves Geneva, sort of, you know, he's tossed out in 1538, he's preaching. He would always preach just straight through books. And so he's preaching, and when he comes back, now he's been away for 3 years, and the Genevan town fathers have said, they've even said to some degree, well, we were wrong in the way we treated you, we want you back, we want you here to work to help reform our town and all this. And so, you know, he gets up in the pulpit, literally, this is true, and what's he going to say? I mean, you know, is he going to blast them, or is he going to say, I'm glad this has happened? He picks up right where he left off 3 years earlier, no comment, He picks up right where it was like he was just gone for a day, and he picks right up, makes no comments. That's Calvin, very typical. He's going right back to the Bible. He's going to preach the Word. He's not going to get into commentary about things, not in the pulpit. In other places, he might get into commentary. Well, Calvin didn't gain the fuller support on the and the council until 1555. Even though he goes back, he works all through the 40s and the 50s. He didn't become a citizen until 1559. Remember, he dies in 64, which gives the lie to the charge. And this is a charge that's out there a lot. Bruce Gordon deals with this in his book. Gordon is pretty harsh on Calvin at some points. I think Zelderheis is more fair. Certainly T.H.L. Parker, the classic biography, is fair. And so is Stickelberger, is quite kind. But they deal with this tyrant of Geneva. And if he was a tyrant, he was one of the more ineffectual ones in some ways. I do have to mention this, because it's taken as one of the great black marks against Calvin, is the trial and execution of Servetus. Michael Servetus was a Trinitarian heretic. He denied the Trinity. He was under the condemnation of the Roman Catholic Church. He had had correspondence taunting Calvin, and he came to Geneva, really taunting Calvin. And Calvin tried to dissuade him, but Servetus came there. He was arrested. Calvin did act as the prosecutor, and some Calvin scholars who are very favorable to Calvin say, well, he was kind to Servetus, because when Servetus was convicted and the judgment was passed of execution, Calvin tried to have him beheaded rather than burned. Okay, well, I understand beheading is maybe a little... and Servetus was executed on 27 October 1553. And you have to understand, Servetus was seen as much as a threat to the civil order and a disturbance, and a threat to the state as much as to the church. I say all that, though, not to justify what was done there, because I don't think it was properly justified, and I don't think I need to say more than that. It's something that happened historically. We can look at it, we can think about it, but I don't feel any sort of impulse to justify in any great way what Calvin did there. We have, in many things, we've lost some things, and other things we've come to some better thoughts, I believe, about things. Calvin continued his work there, putting the Institutes in final form by 1559, as we'd said, and corresponding extensively with those engaged in the work of reform throughout Europe. When Edward VI, the son of Henry VIII, came to the throne in 1547 to 1553, 1547 to 53, he was only 9 years old. He was 16 when he died. He's often called the second Josiah, and he did a great work of really under him. There was a great work by Cranmer and a number of others of reforming the English church. Calvin was in correspondence with folk there. And then after Bloody Mary, she was 1553 to 58, after Elizabeth came back to the throne, he was in extensive correspondence with Cecil, the foreign secretary. And he had a lot of influence. And what's interesting, as adamant as Calvin was, he would be writing those in these churches and saying, you know, to the people even in the English church, no, I know you have episcopacy, but you can work with this. You need to not, we have to work with what's there. So Calvin was willing to work with what was there. Well, I'm going to just wrap it up here. I've just scratched the surface here with Calvin. But to say this, he continued working and preaching to the end, even preaching from his bed shortly before his death. He had preached sitting down, and then he literally couldn't get out of bed, and he said, "Take me in bed," and they took him in bed and put him up there, and he preached to the congregation. Now, this is the ever-ready bunny or something of theologians, I'm telling you. He really was amazing. And one thing that Zelderhuis says at the end of his work, Calvin is buried in an unmarked grave. He didn't want it marked. Calvin would be horrified, to be very frank with you, that we're called Calvinists. He really would. Luther had a church that was called Lutherans, and he knew where that was going. Calvin did not want anybody called after his name. He didn't. And he really was, in one way, very self-effacing. And Zelderhuis says, he's not an unknown buried in a great tomb. I gave this talk on the 10th, a talk like this on the 10th of July. I gave one right on his birthday. I'd given one a few days earlier. And my sons and I had just visited the previous day the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. So it was very vivid, you know. There you have a great tomb with an impressive guard, very impressive. So I'm sure some of you have been to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And there you have this, as we say, an unknown buried in a great tomb. But with Calvin, we have a great Christian soldier who was buried in an unknown tomb at his insistence. And this is something of the life of John Calvin, who and his work, though we didn't, I'd hoped to get into some substance of his theology, but I guess that was foolish. I wanted to give you some of the main outlines of his theology. But you'll get that somewhat in the 5 points. And that's part of it. That's part of it. Calvin was a man who, above everything, wanted to glorify God in everything he did. Thank you.